All right, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Tarek. All right. If you guys would indulge me, I'd like to tell you a story about a friend of mine. We're an oral society, and these stories have become such an important part of my journey now. I used to be a head guy, an information guy. You know, a wise man says, you know, I was so interested in the menu, and I tried to eat the menu. You know, I thought the big book was the treasure. All it is it's a map, and everyone finds a treasure at the end of that map. And this story, I heard it, and it's interesting how my mind works when I hear stories, and when they speak to the heart, there's something that just, they integrate into who I am immediately. And I try to make them my own. But this was a story that I heard from one of my heroes, and I can't help but repeat it because I think it's what we all face here. It's about a guy named Joe. And Joe spent the majority of his first 30 years alive in a state of uneasiness. He was easily annoyed by people, situations, and he was dissatisfied with life. He was socially awkward. He was terrified of talking to women. And he was riddled with financial insecurity. And he was carrying a heavy load. And when you're carrying a load like that your entire lives and you don't tell anybody, at some point for some people, what ends up happening is you might consider jumping off a bridge. And that's what Joe was considering. And people feared for his life. You know, he had started to develop some consequences from his isolation. And he couldn't experience a true bond with another human being, even his wife. And his friends were concerned about him. And they'd heard of a friend of his who had had the same problem growing up. And somewhere in his early 30s, we're going to call this man Charlie. Charlie had found a solution. And so Joe's family and friends thought it was a good idea to set up a meeting between Joe and Charlie. And so they took Joe over to Charlie's house. Joe sat down and Charlie introduced himself and proceeded to tell Joe his story. And Charlie said, you know, I grew up that way. I grew up restless, I grew up irritable, and I grew up discontent. I felt like I was outside the circle of life looking in, and everybody else had a playbook, and I didn't get the playbook. I had two left feet, and I couldn't dance, and I was terrified of females. And I understand 100% what you have been through. And they found an identification, Joe and Charlie. Charlie said, you know, Joe, I do have an answer for you. More than an answer, I have a solution for you. Have you ever considered taking a drink? He said, you know, for about 90% of the population, when they take a drink, it's just another event. It's like going to get a pedicure. It's like going to the donut shop to eat a donut. But for 10% of the population, it's transformational. For 10% of the population, when we take a drink, we have a vast change in feeling and outlook. When we take a drink, we have a profound alteration in our reaction to life. When we take a drink, we become psychically different. We have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from our insecurity. Would you like to take a drink? And Joe says, no, no, no. My family, there was these ominous warnings. I had a cousin who disappeared. They never knew what happened to him. They said alcohol and drugs were involved. I've had other family members that have trouble. My family will cut me off. I just don't think it's something I'm willing to do. You know, I think I'm going to try some other alternatives. And Charlie says, are you sure? You know, because I just happen to have a bottle of scotch underneath the table. Would you be willing to take this course of action? I promise you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. You will have a vast change in feeling and outlook if you take this drink. You will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle you. Fear of people and economic insecurity will just leave you. Self-seeking will slip away. You'll want to buy everybody a drink. You will be on a path in life that really goes somewhere. You'll be catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence that you've never dreamed of. Would you be willing to take this drink? But I do have to warn you, sippers do not make it. Lightweights do not get very far. What do you think? I can show you how to do this. I can show you precisely what I have done. And Joe just wasn't buying in. Joe's ego was too intact. And Joe decided to leave. And Charlie said, well, here's my number. If you ever change your mind, please call me. I'd love to talk. So Joe leaves Charlie's house and hops in the car with his friends. And they ask him about it. He goes, man, that guy was weird. He told me I'd be catapulted into the fourth dimension, that I would tap an unsuspecting inner resource, that alcohol would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm not buying into it. I just don't think that's going to work for me. And so Joe went on for the rest of his life, restless, irritable, discontent, not satisfied, no sense of purpose, isolated. And at age 70, he was sitting on his deathbed, and his wife was by his side. And he was drifting in and out of consciousness. And he drifted away this one time, and his wife noticed it. And then he returned. And she said, where'd you go? He said, you know, I just went back to 40 years ago when I sat with that guy. And I was wondering, what would have happened if I'd taken that drink? And then he died. Is that much different than what we have available to us here? This is the turning point. And I guess it's imperative and necessary and required that the ego, I don't believe it's ever destroyed, but it's thinned out enough to where there's traces of it left, and it's no longer in the foreground, but it gets pushed into the background, and it creates an opening. It's where grace and opportunity meet, and God makes that introduction. And without that, well, we're just like Joe. How many Joes have we seen that just don't buy in what we're trying to sell? You know, and we try to model it. We try to deliver the message, although all we can do is carry the message. We won't. If you have had an awakened spirit, truly, you will run over anybody to give this to somebody else. Giving it away is not even an option. I know many people that have worked these 12 steps and have not had an awakened spirit because they only sponsor when it's convenient. That's just Tarek's opinion right there, air quotations. And so I want to read something out of the 12 and 12. Maybe there are as many definitions of spiritual awakening as there are people who have had them, but certainly each genuine one has something in common with all the others. And these things which they have in common are not too hard to understand. When a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift, received freely, I've added those words, which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere, that his life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which, in one way or another, he has denied himself up to this point. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, peace of mind, and love of which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, it's at least in some small part, we have to make ourselves ready to receive it. Alcoholics Anonymous' manner of making ready to receive this gift lies in the practice of the 12 steps in our program. Lies in the practice of the 12 steps in our program. This gift. I have gifts that are sitting in this room right now. I mean, I have some dear friends. I have the first man that truly carried the message to me sitting in this room. He's one of my closest and dearest human beings. I love him to death. You guys in this room know who you are that are my gifts. But what if I told you that getting molested at age 5, 6, and 7 was a gift? What if I told you my mom not being able to handle having an alcoholic father and screaming and pulling hair and slapping her face and packing her bags and leaving was a gift? It's shown up in my character defects. It's put me on a collision course with people and situations. It still influences me. You know, what if filing bankruptcy, losing my home, living out of hotels, doing the aimless walk at 3, 4 in the morning, these were wonderful gifts. What if the best thing God ever did for me was create me as a crackhead? Those are some of the most powerful gifts I have in my life. I can't tell you the number of men that I've gotten to sit down with and talk to. By disclosing those intimate details about my life, I get them to get and disclose those details about their lives. They're no longer alone. I don't know if we truly ever heal from these psychological wounds, some of them physical, but we do integrate them into who we are as a human being. We get to rewrite the past, believe it or not, in this program. And I heard a guy at another retreat not too long ago said, we have an unfair advantage over society. I swear to God, that shit hit me right. Oh, sorry, I'm trying not to cuss. It hit me so hard when he said unfair advantage. I was at that same retreat. How do you meet a total stranger and then all of a sudden you're talking about sexual abuse? How does that happen? Where in this world do you find this type of opening in Alcoholics Anonymous? Our stories. Our stories are the gifts. I'm a profound believer that music is very spiritual. And for me, it's always been a spiritual experience. Those of you who know my story know how important it was in my story, but I don't have time to get into all that this evening. But I was listening to some music on the way up today, and I listened to it's the Sons of Anarchy soundtrack, but... There's a song by this guy, and the name of the song is called Lost Soul. Lost Soul. And the chorus of the song is, I will not let my future go on without the help of my soul. I will not let my future go on without the help of my soul. And then I listened to Michael Jackson. Remember the time when we first met. Remember the time when we fell in love. I have to remember when I fell in love with alcohol and these drugs. I have to remember the time I met them. Because if they hadn't done a tremendous amount for me, they would have never done a tremendous amount to me. And the soul we have a pervasive soul sickness in chapter 4 in the 12 and 12. This is a book by a mystic, a 12th century mystic. And I want to read something. I want to see where my talk goes after this. In many spiritual texts, they refer to three levels or stages of development. If you're in the 12-step program, it is a purification and human development program, if you're not aware of that. The development of the soul. While the spirit within is always in a state of perfection, the soul may become tarnished. We become driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We have pride. Our instincts are run amok. Not only do we have desires for security, for society, for power, we have appetites, we have passions, we have reasoning, we have judgment. Natural attributes for a human being. But in us, there's something faulty in how we engage these instincts that are God-given. For many spiritual aspirants, perfecting of the soul is a path of transformation which requires determination and effort. No one loves the self-searching, the leveling of pride, and the confession of shortcomings, which this process requires if you're to get any movement, any evolution, and any growth. This determination and effort, even though it is acknowledged, here's the part that really gets me. It can only be achieved through divine grace. You remember what the 12 and 12 says? We have to make ourselves available. The first miracle we experience based on our track record with drugs and alcohol is the miracle of separation. The miracle has to happen very fast. Otherwise, the speaker's not up here tonight. But the other miracles that happen, and there's so many of them, one of which is the return of our sanity. The return of the sanity somehow happens in that first pass of the steps. For many of us, the obsession is removed before we ever work a step. That was my experience. I was struck sober and then delivered to the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. And I was delivered to you fine folks. One man sitting back there in specific who took me under his wing and he modeled the program of recovery to me. The lowest level of self mentioned in the spiritual text is the self which is incites to evil, the ego. Let's for a minute assume those are synonymous, because it says often called the ego, the carnal self, or the commanding self which is driven by the instincts that I mentioned before. Then when the person starts questioning after a surrender, a spiritual surrender. I did not make a choice to surrender. I was surrendered. I never want to place myself in a position where I say I've made a choice today to not drink and not do drugs. I make a lot of choices every day, but by the grace and mercy of God, drinking and drugging are not a choice that comes on my array of choices to make. But when we do have this surrender and we begin questioning their purpose in life, this is the part, the crazy part, is this is what happened to me. I got clean and sober at 31 and I began to question my purpose in life. I got set on a spiritual path to knowledge of the soul and an experience with God. I became aware of my own defects, my shortcomings, my instincts, my weaknesses, my strengths, and my lack of commitment and integrity. And I began to blame myself for these deficiencies. This is progress, and we call this the level of the blaming self. But not, in my experience, a neurotic blaming. A curiosity of why I'm behaving this way so I can have a reckoning with my character every day. Because my character and how I engage with you, this is what this path is about. And so, finally, the self, which is at a level of perfection, is called the soul at peace. And this is, I think, the ideal we want to grow towards. And so I have all these gifts that I mentioned from all these stories, and I'm like, how do I get from this? This is the memory that came to me when I was driving today. I had come home from college, and I grew up in an alcoholic home. Anyone in here grew up in an alcoholic home? You all remember the flesh on flesh in the middle of the night. You remember the things that broke in the middle of the night. You remember the screaming and the yelling in the middle of the night. And then we tell ourselves, there's alcohol's got it, because my dad's drinking all the time. Alcohol is involved. And then I make a firm resolution. I'm never going to be like my father. I'm never going to drink. But I'm a restless and irritable and discontent individual. And I'm from the Middle East, and I look like I'm Irish. And so I go meet all my friends in the South, and they introduce me as Tarek, and they do not understand what they have just met, right? And so I do sit with this amplified state of I'm on the outside looking in. I don't belong here. The people's eyes in this party that I'm at are not friendly. They're continuously telling me we've got enough friends. And so I want to feel a part of, I want to step into that circle of life. And I discovered the elixir we call the spirits. Alcohol is called spirits for a reason. But was it a low-grade desire or longing for something else that I wasn't aware of? And so I come home from college, and I guess my dad used to be physical with my mother. And my grandmother, and he was a tyrant. And I remember like being on staircases where he would stomp on me and my brother. And I had just walked in after my brother had whooped my dad's ass. Excuse my language. He had beat my dad up because my dad was doing something to my mom. So my dad had a big red mark, welt on the side of his cheek. And I remember my mom was being in the bathroom, so I ran into their bedroom, which was just inside the garage. And my grandmother was horrified by what was going on. And I remember, like, hearing of all this news. And I remember my dad was, like, standing outside of the bedroom. And I'm walking outside, and I looked him dead in his face, and I spit in my father's face. I told him he was a piece of shit. You know, and I'd already excommunicated him from my life. But, I mean, you know, granted, I was 18 or 19 by this point, and so I don't really have a relationship with my father until I go make amends with him. And so I said earlier, how do we get from there to what I'm about to describe without the power of God? And so in my first fifth step, I had 16 or 17 different resentments against my father, and there's a whole list of them. And every single one, the guy listening to my fifth step would ask me if I had done that to someone I cared about, physically abusive, forgot their birthdays, didn't show up to events I said I was going to be at. The list goes on and on. And at some point in that fifth step, my head dropped, and I realized I'd become my father. And, you know, my Friday night home group is called Over the Bridge, because you have to walk in our inventory process. The space between the third and the fourth column is where the magic happens. The space between the third and the fourth column is where compassion is born. The space between the third and the fourth column requires an opening of the heart. And I remember going to my father at 31, who is now in a one-bedroom condo. No one in his life. My parents have now been divorced. My brother never wanted to do anything to do with my father until my father passed away. And my father had one cousin that would come to see him. And I went to make amends to my dad. I did this early on. So this was probably 2008 when I made this amends to my father. And how do I go from spitting in this man's face, having pulled him off my mother and slammed him against the wall several times, grabbed him by the neck and threw him up against the wall just to keep him away from my grandmother? My first memory as a human being is my mom running into this bedroom, and I'm in a playpen, and my dad standing over her on the bed while she's like crying, him screaming at her. I asked my mom what that was about, and she had gotten some tickets to go see a play. But my dad had, you know, someone asked him the wrong question. Do you want a drink? And he took that drink, and then the drink took him. And he didn't take my mom to the play that night. And that's the first memory I have as a human being. I asked her about it. What was that? And so I make this amends with my father, and I ask him that all-important question of what can I do to make things right? And he said, I want you to be happy, and I want you to spend time with me. And so I started taking my father to lunch or dinner and a movie every Sunday when I was in town. Eventually, my ex-wife and I opened up our home to him where he would come over. As my mother saw this change, they started inviting, my stepdad and mother started inviting my dad to these functions. I fell in love with this man. And so in June of 2016, he was diagnosed with liver cancer. His death certificate may say cancer, but alcoholism is what killed him. I took him to every chemo. I was so I was going through a divorce, been asked to leave my home. I was staying in Miss Lindsay's guest bedroom. Bless her heart, I kept her up to 2 or 3 in the morning every night. I was curled up in the fetal position, begging God to keep me safe and protected because everything had failed. I'm this pillar in the recovery, at least I thought I was, a pillar in the recovery community. What are all these people going to think that I'm getting a divorce and all the stuff that comes with that and all the stories? And I'm sitting there, and I'm taking my father the chemo, and eventually they say, we found this chemo cocktail, and we can keep you alive and keep the tumors from growing. And I remember my father turned to me in the doctor's office and said, I can't do it. And so we took him off to chemo in January. By March, the cancer had spread to his brain. We were at a restaurant. He stood up and started taking all his clothes off in the restaurant. That's when I knew it spread to the brain. Without Alcoholics Anonymous and without the power of God and without the men and women, many of which are in this room, what I'm about to share with you would not be possible. My parents let me bring my father into their home so I could take care of him because his Medicaid only offered palliative care, which meant a nurse could sit at the house, but she couldn't administer any of the medication. I had to crush up the Oxycontin, I had to crush up the Dilaudid, I had to put it all in a syringe, and I had to put it in my father. And that nurse said, you do that better than most of the nurses I know. And this one day when I felt Mark Houston used to talk about feeling God and experiencing God and sensing God in the pots and the pans. I was changing my dad's diaper with my stepdad. And I got hit with the taste of God. How do we go from spitting in his face, physically, being physical with him, telling him he was a piece of you-know-what? How do I go from that place to the place I just described? To where I was looking in his eyes when he took his last breath. You know, in full transparency right now, because this may create some accountability, I made a promise to my father. He kept hanging on for days, and the nurses didn't understand what he was waiting for. My mom intuitively knew. I wouldn't say anything about my brother, because my brother and I are still estranged. And I finally, one day, the intuition, that sixth sense that we hear, right, that needs to be cultivated and practiced. It spoke to me on this one afternoon when I knew he was close and he looked right at me and I leaned over and I'm rubbing his forehead and I said, Dad, I'll take care of Mom. I'll take care of Chad. You can go. And he looked up and he took his last breath and he was gone. And I'm telling all of you people in this room, I'm not backing up that promise. You know, I've tried to reach out to my brother, but I can do better. I've been selfish because I don't want my brother in my life because he makes my life more difficult. But that one's eating me right now that I made a promise to my father. You know, I believe that every day I have my spiritual bread. I don't need to increase it. It's going to be there. It doesn't matter what the calamity is. Calamity is my providence. You know, it's providential, man. God, my deepening in my relationship with God happens in the calamity. You know, and I know there's one that's going to find me, and that one is death. It's going to find everybody in this room. And what about this life that we're living? Is it about preparing for that moment? Your tombstone, my tombstone has October 12th, 1976, dash, November 5th, 2007, dash. I'm in my second dash. You know, Mark and Don used to say, what are you doing with your dash? Are you preparing for the next date? The greatest gift God has ever given me. All those things I just talked about. But if I had to pick one, the greatest gift God has given me is my recovery. And what I do with that recovery is my gift back to God. And I hope God is as pleased with my gift to him as I am with his gift to me. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Tarek.
I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Brandon. And I have a sponsor, and he is a sponsor. And I sponsor people, and they sponsor people. My sobriety date's June 15th, 2011. That was not the day I picked. That was the day that was struck. I was struck sober by a power I didn't even believe in and still sometimes don't understand. I've got a couple house cleaning things before I get going. Though, like Frank, did you notice how like when Lindsay walked in late, she didn't get called down to the front row?
Oh, yeah. I got seats up here for you, Miss Lindsay and Jamie.
I was waiting. I didn't know.
And those of you within your first, you know, 5 or 6 years of sobriety, did you notice what happens to you when you get 7 years of sobriety? When you looked at Nick and Satcher? Get really good in shape. I don't remember that phase of my sobriety. Must have just passed right by it or something. It's floating out in the clouds or something. I don't know. We're good. Everybody enjoy walking over and getting soaked in the rain and coming back? Anybody change when they got back?
No.
Yeah, I did. I put on my the shirt I wore to Taylor Swift. I have a daughter. It gives me an excuse. But so I was in there changing. Took my socks off, my shoes off. Apparently my underwear was even wet. And so I put on dry clothes, and it just kind of felt really good after all that, right? Like dry socks, it's kind of nice. And I kind of equate that to kind of like what early sobriety was like, is this you get this new feeling that's comfortable, and it feels good, and you're not just a wreck anymore. But then I see a bunch of people just kind of, that's enough. That's enough for them. And I was, last weekend I was at a spiritual retreat with some seemingly earth people. Very advanced spiritually. People that have all sorts of abilities, and we did some yoga and chanting and singing and meditation and all this stuff. But like one of the parts of the entire weekend that was most interesting to me is that I was having a conversation with a guy, and we were over the course of the weekend, my stepson kept calling me with wanting additional tips on some meditation and tips on focus and trying to overcome his procrastination and all these things. And during the breaks, these people would hear me have some of these conversations with them. And then at some point in time, my wife was with me, and we were explaining how it's amazing that he calls me, because this kid from age 5 to, he's 18 now, so probably 5 to 13 was basically on every single inventory I wrote. One of my greatest teachers. I was explaining this, like, and one of the guys said, well, what is this inventory thing that you're talking about? And I said, well, it's probably better that I just read you a piece. And I just happened to have a sponsee that wasn't acting appropriately that I had to write a piece of inventory on. And I pulled it out. We had to we kind of set the table and explained, you know, what column one was and column two was and column three and column four and these realizations. And like literally everybody at this retreat stopped what they were doing and they were listening to me read this piece of inventory, which column three, written out in the long form, revealing how I think. These people have been at this spiritual retreat with me, and they're like looking at me like, what's wrong with this dude? and being able to explain it, and then they understood why it was such a big deal that my stepson is calling me for advice on things because of that process. And so one of the things that I've been super reflective about over the course of, it's really been the last couple, probably month or so. One of the guys that was, the guy that was facilitating the retreat was a gentleman that had started essentially this conference at another monastery years ago. And I was at his place for this retreat, and it got me reflecting about the experience of my first retreat, my first conference that I went to, and like reflecting at like how much different this gentleman is and how much different I am from that, because I was 90 days. I had called the guy to try to go to the retreat, and he's like, well, and I had to go home and coach my kids in soccer on Saturday morning, and so I was gonna miss a couple sessions, and there were these twin brothers from Texas that were facilitating it, and so I got there Friday night, and like I walk into this room and I'm listening to these guys and they're talking about stuff from this book that I haven't heard before. And they're transmitting a message in a way that was transformational for like my level of excitement of what could happen if I actually did this. And the guy that was putting the retreat on, when I told him I had to leave Saturday morning, he said, well, usually I would just tell you to just come next year, but something tells me that you're supposed to be here. And so I left first thing Saturday morning, went away, and those of you who know the gentleman, like when I got back, I said, is there any way I could listen to the recording from this morning? And he said, I'm really reluctant to do this because this is my only copy. And this is back like when you had to record it on the tape recorder. And he goes, and I'm just worried something's going to happen to it. But he says, I think you need to hear it. Right. And so like knowing this guy who he was then versus who he is now, it's like that was a huge thing for this guy to relinquish the control of his only recording so that I could catch up this guy that had 90 days that was coming to have a spiritual experience. And then I got a new sponsor at that retreat and went home and started working the steps and had this transformative experience. And so I've been also observing the number of guys in my network that I've been talking to over the course of this week who have full knowledge that this retreat is here and have heard from a multitude of you who attend this on a regular basis how awesome it is, and, well, they're still at home. And I don't know what that was for me that got me excited to be here that first time, but once you've been here, and you've been through this process, something happens and you just get lit up and you want more. And you want to have this experience again and again and again with different people, with the same people. And so what I would encourage those of you who maybe this is your second year here is to watch what happens with the people that this is their first time. And to watch what happens from day one to day three. And for those of you who have been here before, observe how much different this experience is to you this year than last year or the year before. Because it's different facilitators, but we're kind of talking about the same stuff. And have a new experience and observe the new experience. And if you've been coming to these things for a long time, you know what to do, but maybe just open your heart up a little bit to somebody else that needs that little extra, that needs that little extra love this weekend, and that seems to be hanging out off to the side and needs a little bit more, and offer it to them. So what do you need? Do you even know what you need? Are you even open to the possibility of something new? Because some of us come because we think we're supposed to, but we don't know why we're here. But why are you here? What's the intent that you've come here with? Because I'm still excited to come to these things. I'm excited to see old friends and meet some new friends and have some new experiences. And I'm really excited about this year because we get to listen to a couple guys who like have to live this way of life because their life depends on it. And we get to listen to a woman who's one of those strange people that she comes and does this way of life because she does it and her life, well, maybe it depends on it, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But it's the people that pursue the spiritual path that aren't going to die if they don't are some of the most powerful people to listen to and to hear their experience with whatever it is that they call God. And we got to hear a couple tell us about what that's like. I don't necessarily want Carrie here correcting all of my stuff that I talk about. So it'll be interesting to see how this interaction works. But I know I tell the story that way because it's better. So I've also, I found, I've been looking for this one talk that I used to listen to regularly in early sobriety. It's this talk by this guy named Wayne Butler, and he's talking about this, the subject of it is finding your purpose, and he talks about this finding his purpose, and spoiler alert, because I've been looking for the talk for 10 years and couldn't find it until I accidentally found it in my CD case, which I had no idea where it was. I was looking for something else, and I was like, oh, here's my CD case, and I open it, and like, there's the CD. But he tells this very elaborate story about like his mother dying and a sponsee dying, and he said that he found his purpose through this, and what he found was that his purpose is to be a pawn for God and the great chess master, and to have God move us around and do what we're supposed to do. But the thing that he kept talking about was this hope, right? Is the thing that kept his mom going at the end was this hope. The thing that kept his sponsee going at the end when he knew he was going to die was this hope. And so we've got this program which gives those people that really have no way to live, and it gives them hope. It gives them a hope that actually your life is worth something. Actually, you might be able to contribute something. And I've seen it over the last year, because some of you know, some of you don't. But a couple years ago, my just before this weekend, my dad broke his neck, and he couldn't feel his arms and his legs, and moved his hands and his feet, and he's had some surgeries, and he improved for a year and a half. He made pretty steady progress. He was able to sit up on his own and get up to his walker and move around, and then about 3 or 4 months ago, something kind of went wonky. And he started losing strength, and he was not able to get up by himself, and he wasn't able to walk around. And I watched this guy who was lit up with life all of a sudden just start spiraling into this little depression, because he was starting to get up against this thing where he realized that, like, maybe he peaked, and maybe it's just a slow descend into whatever it is. Now, the good news is we found some stuff, an infection, and he's recovering. But like those 3 to 4 months where he was going downhill, like he had lost hope. You could tell he was kind of giving up, and he just didn't want to really keep on. He had this body that was failing him, this mind that was starting to falter a little bit, and. He was just not really wanting to go on. And again, he's recovered from that, and from here I get to bolt down to the beach and build a ramp for him to go out on the patio at the beach and do some stuff like that, and, you know, spend some family time. And so, but that hope that we get when we show up in the rooms. Okay, and you know, Tarek was talking about it, and it's just I've spent the last year really obsessing about a couple paragraphs on page 124. It's the Henry Ford paragraphs. Once made the wise remark to the effect that experience is a thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past into good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is the only one. Then it goes on to say, this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has not been relieved owes something to those who have not. Families who have been relieved owe something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we are given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. So Tarek was talking about it, that the experience that he had, like, from his childhood, or that he had with the alcoholic father, or any of the struggles that we've had in our life, that when we look at it, it's just a bunch of garbage, right? And it's when we actually start to see that there's value in that garbage is when we start to share that experience with other people. And we get to save misery and death for them by sharing these experiences. And so what that's doing is we get to use our garbage to create hope for somebody else. And so this weekend is effectively a pep rally for God. It's a weekend of like getting you charged up about the possibility that your story has a ton of hope in it, not only for you, but for other people. But the key is that when we get here, we have to do something. We have to do something with it, or it stays garbage. So the people that have come in and come out and come in and out, in and out, in and out, you know, maybe they were never really here. Maybe they just were out, and they're waiting to actually come in. Because when you come in, and you come all the way in, and you sit down, and you do the work, and you have the experience, you can't help but get excited about this. So if you've been one of those people that haven't come all the way in and sit down, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's have an experience. Let's listen. Let's pay attention. Let's listen to the experience of the facilitators this weekend to give us that degree of hope that the garbage that we've been through might actually be worthwhile. And while you're doing it, look around the room and see who else you can give that hope to. And let's just turn this into a big pep rally. What do you think?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's have a pep rally.